Matt Piper, who's been following the Harvey Weinstein trial for CBS in New York. Answer this question, if you could, Matt. The pictures we've seen of Harvey Weinstein indicate that he looks incapacitated as he sort of trundles up to the courtroom in a walker. What exactly is his condition? Could you tell from what you saw?
Well, he has looked that way for the last month or so, using this walker to get inside the courthouse and outside the courthouse. For the first time, actually, yesterday during the verdict, his attorneys said he had unsuccessful back surgery. They've been saying that he had a car crash of some sort in August. He then had surgery on his back due to that car crash in December. And you would think that after having back surgery, you would, you know, look better. But the thing is, he has looked the same, hunched over this walker for a while now. So obviously they say that the back surgery was unsuccessful. They also said that he's under the care of five doctors. So in terms of the hunching over, I guess it's just from this back surgery that apparently did him no good.
And he was taken away in an ambulance to, he's in what, hospital custody or something?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of been new in these overnight hours. So he was taken in an ambulance, supposed to go to Rikers Island, which is a notorious jail here in New York City that, you know, just everyone who's done something really bad in New York goes to. But he's now at Bellevue Hospital, is what everyone is reporting this morning, which is a hospital on the east side, and he was taken there for chest pains. Now, eventually, when he leaves there is when he will go to Rikers. He'll spend 2 weeks there, and then 2 weeks from tomorrow is his sentencing, March 11th.
Okay, so we still, what would be the sentencing range for the, he was convicted on two counts, right?
He was convicted on two counts. They were really the lesser of the five charges that he faced. It was rape in the third degree and criminal sexual assault. Rape carries as many as 25 years, and the other charge carries up to 4 years. So we're talking about 29 years that he could be sentenced for on March 11th.
Okay, well, that would be essentially a life sentence for him.
It would seem so. I mean, he's 67 years old. That would put him behind bars, you know, until he's almost 97. So, yes, on top of the fact that, remember, that they're on the West Coast, he also faces more charges in California, similar rape allegations that came about 6 weeks ago. So that's a whole new case and whole other charges that he could also eventually be tried for and sentenced for. So, yes, safe to say he could be behind bars for the rest of his life.
Was he surprised by the convictions? I saw a report that he seemed to be whispering or saying to his lawyers, but I'm innocent.
Yeah, one of his attorneys, Arthur Idella, said, I'm an innocent man, I'm an innocent man. You know, in the courtroom, it was hard for every single one of us to see because there were so many court officers behind him. His back was to us the whole time. We did see him speak to his attorneys. They told us what he said. But literally within 2 minutes, he was handcuffed and walked out of a side door of the courtroom. So we couldn't actually see his face. But given what his attorneys say, he was claiming that he's innocent. And his attorneys already say that they do also plan to appeal.
Right. Was it a surprise to anybody that he was only convicted on two of the counts? And what made the difference? What was the problem with proving the other counts?
It seems that the jury did not believe some testimony, including one of the bigger names that prosecutors brought up there, Annabelle Sciorra, the Sopranos actress. She was one of those five counts and one of the ones that he was found that he was acquitted of. So it seems that of the really serious charge was predatory sexual assault, which essentially was going to show, okay, he did this to more than two people, which he was acquitted of. So it never got to anything in terms of showing that this is predatory behavior. So really, the jury believed the other two accusers of his, which really this case focused on, a former production assistant and an aspiring actress. I think that for accusers, there's about 100 of them around the world. You know, I was talking with some yesterday. There are some who were happy that at least he did get something, but others who think, okay, I wish that he had gotten more. So, you know, there's people on both sides.
So when you say the jury apparently didn't believe them, did they think the witnesses were making it up or that it was, in fact, consensual?
It's hard to say. I think that for in Sciorra's case, I believe he allegedly broke into her Gramercy Park apartment back in the mid-90s. But then they had a doorman, a super of that time from way back when, who said, well, we had high security. He wouldn't have been able to get in there unless he knew that he was able to go in. You know, we weren't going to just let him in. So there was some, you know, questions about testimony of, well, how did he barge in if you let him up? And how, why did you continue this working relationship with him if this happened? Things of that nature. So it seems the jurors, maybe didn't believe some of these people who maintained relationships with him after the fact.
CBS's Matt Piper covering the Harvey Weinstein verdict. Matt, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Now joining us, Hannah Scott, who's been covering the legislature. And let's go through the list here. Legalized sports betting. Where does that stand?
It is moving, and this is going to be just at the tribal casinos. So far, there was a lot of pushback from some local companies who wanted to legalize it in card rooms, and so far that hasn't caught on. So that still needs to get one more vote, though, before it's a done deal.
Is it your opinion that is going to get the vote?
I think so. And I think that the argument to try to put it in the card rooms is because if you just do it in the casinos, the tribal casinos, you're not going to get any tax dollars from it. So that's why there's the push to put it in the card rooms from those in that business. But there's a real hesitation to go wide with this early.
Because it would challenge the casinos, or because it would be moral depravity?
Because the latter, more or less. They're just kind of slow rolling the idea, and it seems like the tribal casinos have their, you know, ducks in a row as far as dealing with
the gambling situation. I think we crossed the depravity line long ago. But anyway. All right, on the death penalty then.
So a lot of really, really emotional testimony on this yesterday. This is the bill that we had yesterday, of course, in 2018. A state Supreme Court decision found that Washington's death penalty was unconstitutional as applied because it's handed out in an arbitrary and racially biased manner. Now, the push to fight against that left the legislature with the option of abolishing it or trying to fix it, and there's been this push to abolish it ever since. Last year, it failed, this bill, because Representative Jenny Graham over in the House, whose sister was killed by the Green River Killer, put up a really, really hard fight. She points out that families of dozens of victims from the Green River Killer would never have found out what happened to them, where their bodies were, if the prosecutors did not have the death penalty used as a threat to Ridgway. She continued that fight yesterday, both she and her mother, in the hearing on this bill.
I expect you, the legislature, to make this right. My daughter demands it. Murder victims demand justice today. It is about murder victims and the cruel death forced on them. The death penalty saves lives.
If you have seen my anger today, I have no apologies for it. When the people that commit these crimes are the ones that we go out of our way for. Enough is enough.
Many in law enforcement also strongly opposed, according to James McMahon. He's with the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs and made this point that we've heard before.
You haven't yet heard today the name Jamie Bindle, who is a corrections officer at the Monroe Correctional Facility, who was murdered, raped and murdered by somebody who is already imprisoned with life without the possibility of parole. What shall we do for Jamie Bindle under this bill?
But a string of former corrections department leaders and the Snohomish County prosecutor, as well as Laura Zarowski with the Washington Innocence Project, fought back with this.
Each of us has been up close and personal to what it takes to kill another human being in our custody. Our experience has taught us that no one, not an individual or the state, should end another's life as a function of government.
The bottom line is this is a fallible system. It's run through a system that is necessarily, unfortunately, impacted by human bias and by imperfect information. And as long as that's true, the risk of executing an actually innocent person will always persist.
So really, still a very heated argument. We had other victims' families that spoke yesterday about how difficult it is to go through the years-long process of a capital punishment case. And they're just overall they don't support taking someone else's life, regardless of the circumstances. And there was one woman who spoke and said that she really pleaded with the room, please let's not pit victims' families on others' opposite sides of this debate against one another. She didn't want it to get
right.
To
well, how about this? This may be controversial, but how about leaving it as a choice for the families of the victims.
And there's been amendments and a push to try to do it, and they fail. There's been last session, there was so many amendments to this to try to allow it for the case of a murdered law enforcement officer or a corrections officer. All of these fail. Does this pass this session? I don't know. I'm surprised it's gotten this far again already in this short session. She's going to put up a big fight, Jenny Graham, again in the House. We'll see if it gets brought to the floor. That's the last step at this point. Another controversial bill is one step away from passage. This is the one we talked about previously, the reduction of the penalty for intentionally infecting somebody with HIV. Currently, a felony would be reduced to a misdemeanor under this bill. The idea to end the stigma and increase public health, get people willing to be tested.
This is because HIV is considered curable now?
Right. So here's Monica Dinger. She'll explain why.
HIV, decades and decades ago, could have been a death sentence. It no longer is. And so our criminal justice has to reflect the harm today versus what it used to be.
But Republicans had a lot of concerns with that.
And I think that we all have to look at these things from if they did it to me or they did it to my child. What would I feel and what would I hope for? And I would hope that there would be criminal justice.
Just doing simple math, if someone were infected when they were 20 years old, when their brain wasn't even fully formed, they contract this disease from someone who knowingly and willingly infected them, if they live to 70, and that's a big if, they'll spend $1 million.
And that's Ann Rivers. She said that we would normally prosecute someone for theft with that kind of dollar amount involved. There was an amendment from Steve O'Bann who wanted to say at least if they do it repeatedly, we could raise it back to a felony offenses.
I must admit, I'm unsure. So when they say HIV is curable, it is curable only if you take drugs for the rest of your life?
Yes.
Or is it like the flu, you get over it?
No. You'll have it forever, and you will be required to take meds for the rest of your life.
Oh, well, that is a substantive difference, though.
It is a big difference, but there's the big push to do this. I don't know if this gets across the finish line. At this point, it has to go to the Senate floor. That's what they passed it out of committee yesterday, and they had the votes there. We'll have to see. I don't know if they have the votes in the full Senate.
We have time for gun bills and a gun bill.
Is coming up. I'll tease that this morning. The replacement bill for the ban on high capacity magazines, 15 rounds or more than 15 rounds, I should say, that is going to have a hearing this morning that I'll be watching, and I'll bring you tomorrow. A lot of both sides of the gun debate are rallying the troops, calling for everybody to come from all over the state to this, and we'll see. But that got a committee hearing, and not everyone was convinced that was going to happen after the original version of that bill died. So we'll see how it goes. I don't know if it'll come to the floor. DUI penalties that we've been following for years, cracking down on repeat offenders. Some good news yesterday in a committee hearing from Senator Padden, who's been behind this. This would make it extends the look back period, so you could get a felony sooner for your fourth DUI. Basically, what this It didn't get funded last year. It didn't get any money in the budget. Budgets came out yesterday, and it did get funded this time. So it just needs one more floor vote. We'll see how it goes.
Okay, so that gets presumably more habitual drunks off the road, right?
Yeah, right now you can go. Fourth DUI in 10 years is a felony right now. This would make it, fourth DUI in 15 years. So they can go longer, in other words, because so many times repeat offenders don't get to that felony level because it's right under that 10-year, right at that 10-year mark. You know what I mean? They escape that. So that's been a big problem. The King County Prosecutor's Office has been pushing for this as well.
Anna Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Choke points. Let's go. The city of Orting, population 8,000, is determined to move at least in the direction of $30 card tabs, even if the rest of the state isn't, and Chris Sullivan is telling us how that's going to work out.
Yeah, Orting residents overwhelmingly supported I-976. 65% of them voted in favor of $30 car tabs. Well, the city council has decided to honor that vote by eliminating its portion of the tab fees. Since 2012, the city has added $20 to the tabs to pay for the city's road maintenance. That fee is now zero. Orting Mayor Joshua Penner says this honors the voters, and it protects against whatever court decision might finally come out of this.
We don't want to have to be in a situation where we're paying this money back. We don't want to be in a situation where we're taking this money in and can't utilize it for the road projects that we promised that we'd get done with it. We would just as rather have it in your pocket as not have it at all.
Mayor Penner says it doesn't really make financial sense to collect money that the courts might eventually decide is unconstitutional.
There's just nobody that can read into that crystal ball. In the meantime, every dollar that's collected after January 1st, when the initiative was supposed to go into effect, is potentially a dollar that has to be paid back.
So he says this is not a small town's political statement. He says it's just budgeting policy, and it's good budgeting policy, he says. And he hopes other cities actually look at this and decide maybe they should do the same thing.
If I was a city council member in another city outside the city of Ording, I'd look at it with the same calculus our city council looked at it, and I'd say, where's the best place for this money if we know that we can't spend it? I hope that they believe the best place for the money is in their citizens' pockets, but it's not my place to tell them that.
Now, Dave, as you mentioned, Ording only has about 8,500 residents, but the $20 tab fee generated $141,000 last year. Mayor Penner says that the city roads are in good shape, and they have reserves should they need to do emergency work.
Taking the citizen of Ording tab fees from $20 to $0 is not going to break our bank in the city of Ording. That's not going to completely redefine transportation funding across the state, but it does shift the conversation away from tab fees, which I think needs to happen because tab fees have become just unsustainable.
Mayor Penner says Ording residents likely pay about $1,500 a year to Sound Transit overall. That's more than they pay to the local schools, local fire, local police. And he says in Ording, they get no benefit for it. And he says that's not an equitable way to fund transportation. So he says his city is doing right by its citizens, and he thinks they need to find a more stable way to raise the money for their for transportation projects than using car tab fees. Hmm. So that's what that's what they're doing in Ording.
I didn't realize Ording was in the Sound Transit District.
Yep, they're at the very far south, east corner of it. I mean, we're talking...
Do they get any bus service or anything?
Probably not what you would expect for $1,500 worth of your, you know, a person a year.
Well, it's expensive to run buses way out there.
Now, that is true. Exactly. And that's why I think they've raised so much money is because everybody knows with $20...
If they don't want buses, then, you know, tell them. I'm sure Sound Transit's looking for ways to save money.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they could find some other ways to deal with it. But yeah, I mean, they're in that far, far deep corner and and nowhere near, you know, a major roadway. So, yeah, so it's interesting what they're doing. They're trying to uphold the will of their voters and doing what they can. I mean, $20 is $20, but, I mean, it's something that they're trying.
I wouldn't expect to see that in other city councils, not any of our larger ones anyway.
Well, true. Yeah, I would expect not. Yeah, because, I mean, that money, you know, they're addicted to it, and they need it. But, yeah, so it's just kind of an interesting, and again, this is a small city trying this where it might not work in a bigger thing, but, I mean, if it can get some conversation going, I'm not sure what's wrong with
it. So, Hannah, where does the whole issue stand at this point?
With I-976, so we've got right now we're waiting for the King County Court to deal with the final two issues that the judge didn't rule on. He upheld most of I-976, the Kelley Blue Book portion, and Bonds and Burien were a portion that has to be worked out. I believe there's a court hearing this week to deal with that. In the legislature, we've got all car tab relief bills are technically still alive until the end of the session. The one that looks like it might get a chance to be voted on is the Senator Marco Elias bill, which is 6606, which gives you $40-$50 off of your car tab. That's for the state portion only, though. That doesn't have any impact, that bill, on your transportation benefit districts, which is the local car tab taxes.
Why can't they enforce the thing as written?
Because why can't they enforce I-976 as written? Because the injunction remains in effect that was put on it by the King County Court.
I mean, but this has not gone to trial yet.
No.
No. So there is a possibility that the court would say, yes, enforce it as written or not.
The judge in King County must first rule on those final two issues. In the last decision that came from him a week or so ago, he said, we're going to leave this temporary injunction, which keeps I-976 from taking effect, in effect until I resolve these other two issues. Should he rule on those two issues and find that he still upholds I-976 with those? I don't know what exactly you would see in court. That would basically, technically, allow that to take effect, but I think you'd see another immediate court.
And in the meantime, is the legislature cutting the budget, or at least coming up with a plan B?
So, in the House Transportation Committee, they released their budget yesterday, and they do shift a great deal of money around to cover the nearly $500 million loss that the I-976 would have. It's largely to deal with the multimodal account, which is what gets your various transportation to cities around. It has largely to do with making sure the vulnerable people with disabilities can get the service that they need. But there is some movement around that. We'll get the Senate transportation proposal today.
By the way, we have a lot of listeners in Ording, apparently. Our state roofing text line, boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
They have no bus service.
They
right
don't.
Now. No, they do not.
Well, they're not getting
according to them, they all have to drive to Sumner to catch the Sound Transit train to catch bus service.
So they're paying for the right to drive to Sumner to get the train.
Pretty much.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, so according to those
I can
folks,
see why they'd feel that way, though.
Yeah. So again, thanks to our guys on the text line, and thanks for listening from Ording. That kind of lets us know what you guys are doing.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Students, parents, and alumni at Kennedy High in Burien, Kennedy Catholic High School in Burien, have been demonstrating against the church's handling of two teachers who resigned after announcing same-sex engagements. And Emily Paulson has a 15-year-old son at Kennedy Catholic High, and you're no stranger to talking about issues involving personal matters. You're a certified professional recovery coach. You came to Christianity through AA, is that correct? And you have participated in these protests, right?
Yes, I have.
Why, if you are unhappy with the church's stand on homosexuality, my first question is, what's your kid doing in a Catholic high school?
Right. That's a question that I think a lot of people are asking themselves and being asked. And I think it's really complicated. For people who come from long lines of Catholicism, like my husband, it's kind of a no-brainer that your kids go to Catholic school. And for me, you know, I married into the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. I married someone who's Catholic. And what we have found in the Catholic community is not what we read in the catechism. What we found, especially in Seattle, we're in this very liberal bubble where everyone's mm-hmm. accepted. And we walk into our parish where there's openly gay members who celebrate and feel accepted. And so I guess it's a little bit of ignorance is bliss when you think that the system you've been in is a lot more accepting than it really is.
When you say it's different than the catechism is a very conservative document.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Did you read anything about this in the catechism before getting involved in the protest?
Sure. I mean, I've read, you know, I know what's in it. And I think everybody who is Catholic knows that that is the Catholic Church stance on homosexuality, that it goes against God's beliefs or whatever. But again, it's not what people feel. It's not really what any of the parents feel, at least the majority. You know, as soon as we got the letter of these teachers voluntarily resigning, mm-hmm. One friend started a Facebook group that grew to 6,000 members, like almost immediately. And so the majority is reflecting the fact that we want to be loving, we want to be accepting, we want to be like Jesus. And that belief, we think, is not being upheld.
Well, the church is trying to thread a needle here. For people who don't know, I'm just going to read what the catechism says. Quote, homosexual acts are intrinsically disordered. They are contrary to natural law. They close the sexual act to the gift of life. That's why the church is officially against birth mm-hmm. control. They do not proceed from a genuine, affective, and sexual complementarity. Not quite sure what that means. But here's the functional line. Under no circumstances can they be approved. So then you might wonder, why does the church have gay parishioners? Which they do, quite a few. And the line appears to be that, number one, these teachers were employed by the Catholic Church in an official capacity. And number two, they made their relationship very public mm-hmm. by announcing an engagement. Because officially, the catechism goes on to say that this inclination, which is objectively disordered, constitutes for most of them a trial. They must be accepted with respect, compassion, and sensitivity, but they are called to chastity in their personal lives.
Exactly. So really,
that's what they're saying.
I think the biggest problem for me is that they're not being allowed the human right of being honest, mm-hmm. right? And
well, they are, as long as they accept the consequences of being honest, which
right.
is to lose your job.
Right. So if they were quiet about it and they had not right. said anything and were not allowed to live in their truth, they would still be employed. And to me, I think that's where I don't want to use the word unfair, but I guess that's where the rub is. And when you look at teachers who have been divorced or, again, use birth control or all of these other reasons, like why are they putting the rules specifically on certain things when you don't apply the rules evenly? It's already discriminatory. There's no way, like, at what point is there privacy?
Yeah. My guessing is, and I think it happens, that if a teacher is gay, they don't get involved in that person's personal life unless it becomes suddenly public, like there's an engagement or a wedding.
Right. And I think that's where people now are in this age where everything is public, where mm-hmm. we are on social media and privacy is now a little more of a fine line.
That's so true.
It's not easy to just say, just leave. If you don't want to be in Catholic school, just leave. Take your kids somewhere else, because that's not how changes occur. And so we are in this difficult place where, at least at our school, you know, enrollment registration is coming up for next year. And do we send in the $550 for next year?
Right.
Or, you know, is that going to change? Is it financial?
That's what I'm wondering. How far are you willing to go? Because a Catholic school, being a privately funded school, if nobody goes anymore, it closes.
Right, right. And then you're juggling not just how your family feels, but when you have a son who really loves a school. And mm-hmm. there's a lot of parent meetings going on. There's a lot of conversation of what now? Mm-hmm. This happened. We protested. Kids are still protesting. Kids from other local Catholic schools are protesting. What now? How do we want to use our dollars? How do we want to speak about this? What do we want to do next? And I guess that's why I'm here. Hearing from teachers at Catholic schools who say, gosh, you know, I read what you wrote in the Seattle Times and I wish I could say something, but we're being asked not to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And to know that, gosh, this isn't even what the teachers want. The teachers are heartbroken and they can't talk about it. And so I just feel obligated to use my voice. And I would just encourage people to speak and get involved if they can, because again, I don't think the answer is just, well, just go to public school. And, you know,
it sounds like you really want to stay. You like the style of education. You just don't like the way they're treating these staff members.
Yeah. I mean, when it comes down to it, yes. And I've been called a cafeteria Catholic and that I'm just picking and choosing what I want to believe, but mm-hmm. the people are the church, the people are the school. And it's really difficult to just, it's not black and white.
The Archbishop wrote a letter which was published in the on the website of the cathedral, and it here's the nugget. Archbishop Etienne says, "Those who teach in our schools are required to uphold our teaching in the classroom and to model it in their personal lives. We recognize and support the right of each individual to make choices. We also understand that some choices have particular consequences for those who represent the church in an official capacity." So it sounds like he's not going to bend on this.
No. It doesn't.
Yeah.
And it's been interesting to see parishes. Some parishes are putting this letter in their bulletins. Some mm-hmm. aren't. You know, the statement that came out from, you know, another local Catholic high school, I think Blanchette and Seattle Prep, it was so much more, there's no word other than kind. It mm-hmm. was so much more kind and in line with what the parents are feeling. And so I think that's what we're left with is, How can we make a change if the Archbishop already has his mind made up? How do we make our voices heard? And how much control does the Archdiocese really have over each individual school?
Emily Paulson, whose 15-year-old son attends Kennedy Catholic High in Burien. Emily, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness now brought to you by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. Now, there's a lot of talk these days about the cost of health care in this country, but for one day in Lincoln, Nebraska, one doctor decided to give his patients a pass on their copay. Dr. Ron Rice runs an urgent care clinic where instead of a bill, he handed out special kindness cards.
I think we have a culture that sometimes forgets that we can have a much better world if we just start being kinder to each other.
His clinic saw nearly 80 patients during the National Random Acts of Kindness Day and covered some $4,000 worth of copays.
That is huge. That's
very generous.
Huge deal.
Yeah.
I mean, you come in and you're not feeling well in the first place, and it's a struggle sometimes.
It was just a nice surprise because nobody likes being sick, so it was a nice little feeling to feel like somebody cares.
So Dr. Rice says this random act was inspired actually by a kind family friend who recently died of cancer.
Even though she had two different types of cancer, was always giving to other people. And so we thought it'd be fun to do this in her honor.
And he hopes his patients will pay it forward. The card he handed out included the hashtag, kindness is contagious. And Dr. Rice says his clinic will likely do this again next year.
Dave. Joining us from G and Ursula, here's G Scott. So are you in favor of sports betting or against it?
Against it.
Why?
100% against it, because this is going to affect people that have low income. When it comes to gambling, like, people that I know that have a lot of money, they like to gamble, and it never affects them. But the folks that I know that don't, when they do gamble, they get in trouble. And I don't like this, because this is what it's going to be. For someone to be able to go to the casino and be able to gamble on games. And I know that you're able to go to Vegas and do it. I like the fact that there is a buffer to go and do those things. I really don't like this. And so we all the time, we're always talking about the homelessness issue. And we're talking about we need to put more money into the homeless and we need to clean up the streets. Well, but then we don't see some of the beginning stages of things like this. These things could possibly wreck homes and families.
Do you think it's because it's just too convenient to gamble on sports since we're surrounded by it? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I also want to add to this. And someone might say, well, gambling's gambling. Dave, have you ever seen someone watch a sporting event and get all emotional and yell at the TV? And oh, yeah. I can't believe that.
Yeah, you.
There is a particular, there's something that sports does to all of us. Whether you have kids, Sully, and watch you, there is an emotion that happens behind that. Well, you take that same emotion. And now you put it and give it an opportunity to go inside of the casino and be able to gamble. And there's so many out here that think they know it all, or they know they could be the GM of a football team, or they know the outcome of the game because they know this expert and they get to write. And one thing about experts that we see on television or you see on radio and the sports, and they're going to tell you who's going to be the best team this year and who's going to be the best football player. And you want to know one thing about the experts? They get it wrong every single day. And then they come back the next day and they give you another prediction. And so the sports gambling, it is just, I'm just so, like, I don't want to see it happen. Again, for rich people, the top 20%, they're fine. Nothing's going to happen to them. They have a lot of money anyways. It's going to be the people that's living paycheck to paycheck.
I think that's what's tempting about sports gambling is that there are so many experts who have opinions. And there are people who think, like you say, that it's a sure thing because they're basing their bet on actual information. And I think it's one of the reasons that there's sports radio, frankly. It's the reason that you have the reason the Wall Street Journal exists. That's for people who bet on stocks, right? They figure if I read enough information, I can predict from day to day which direction the stock market will go. And there are sports fans who say, if I listen to enough stuff, if I read enough stuff, I can successfully predict the outcome of this game and make some money.
You know, as someone who has been in sports radio, and I used to do sports radio, I have an opinion, right? And that's all it really is an opinion. For an example, you could see the report and it could say that this player is questionable or this player is probable or this player is doubtful. But here's what you don't know. You don't know what that player did on Friday night. You don't know if that player maybe skipped out on curfew on Saturday night and didn't get enough sleep.
That's what TMZ is for.
So all of these things come into play when you start talking about gambling. Sully?
Gee, let me ask you this. Yes. I mean, the casinos is one thing, but I mean, if people have an issue with gambling, like a problem with it, they're going to find a guy. There's always been a guy. I mean, I know two guys if I needed to, and I'm not a gambler that, you know, go down on the street, you do something. And, you know, there'll be a way to find it. You think this makes it just a lot more easy, adds the accessibility to it?
I'm glad you brought that up because I don't know a guy, right?
Like I do, and I don't use them.
But let's get to your point. I don't know a guy. Someone listening right now might not know a guy. But I tell you what I do know. I know where the new Emerald Queen Casino is going to be. I know where the Muckleshoot Casino is. I know where the Toledo Casino is. So even though I don't know a guy, which in my honest opinion, those listening right now, out of 10 people listening right now, I bet you only 2 to 3 know a guy or a gal. Let's not just pretend.
Yeah, I think what Chris is saying is if you made it illegal and you tried to enforce it, a lot more guys would pop up because there'd be profit in it for them. Whereas right now, the state tries to take on that thing. They said, we know people are going to gamble, so we might as well regulate it and make some money off it.
Of course. Imagine
like
that.
Pot.
like pot. Imagine that. And again, but this is a situation where the person that just gets off work, because at casinos, you can go and cash your check at the casino.
Yes.
This is the same place that you can leave work. So basically, you can go leave work. You don't go home to your family. You go to the casino. And by the way, you don't need to go anywhere else, Sully. Come right here to our casino, cash your check, make your bet. And before you get home, you've lost your entire paycheck before you see your family.
See, my idea was that you would have a special rule that casinos cannot enforce any debt. The only penalty would be they can keep you out if you welch on your debt, but you can't enforce it. I was told that would just bring back the loan sharks because people would find other ways to borrow the money.
Sully, do you gamble in sports?
No.
Neither do I. I stay away.
I don't even do fantasy football.
Neither do I.
Look at that.
Nope.
Neither do I.
We have two pillars of virtue. If only we could multiply that by, 300.
Do you gamble when you go to Vegas?
Nope.
Okay.
I've been to Vegas six times in the last year and a half. I put like $5 in a slot machine to show Tommy. But no, I don't know. It's a fool's errand. But I'm no good at it.
But like you said, you made the point about, we gotta get out of here. It's getting good.
This will probably come up on G and Ursula, which starts at 9 o'clock.
No, we'll just continue tomorrow.
Take you live to Washington, D.C. now, and Pulitzer Prize winning reporter David Farenthold from The Washington Post. David, I see your latest Twitter activity is a retweet of a story about people sawing through the border fence, the new border fence. Is that what you guys are working on now?
There's a hearing going on with the Department of Homeland Security Secretary about coronavirus and also about the border fence, which, yes, people can saw through. I mean, it's harder than just walking, stepping over the fence, which was the case before. But one thing we've been writing about is how smuggling groups and cartels have figured out ways to get around or through even the new border wall, and how DHS has not really given us any numbers about how often that happens.
Okay, well, oh well. I also heard they have now come up with ladders that are big enough to climb over the higher portions of the concrete wall.
Yeah, apparently there's ladders that are tall enough that you just put it up to the wall and climb up to the top. And I don't know how you get down to the bottom. People are doing.
Yeah. Who thought that would happen? All right, let's go to politics. Bernie Sanders in trouble for his comment about Cuba in the '60s and. I guess you could just blow it off, but apparently it's caused some serious disruptions among Democrats in Florida. How serious is this for him?
I have seen a lot of Democrats reacting. I mean, one of the things that was interesting in 2018 was that the Miami-Dade County Democrats, who include a lot of Cuban Americans, really deserted the Democrats that year and voted for Republicans, which gave Republican senators and governor pretty narrow wins in Florida that year. So you need those Miami-Dade Democrats if you're going to win Florida statewide. And so while I think Sanders' comments about a variety of communist leaders from the past have kind of not been that big of a deal in other places in Florida where that kind of memory is so personal and so close. I've seen a lot of people saying it could be a really big deal for him if he's the nominee.
Does it matter that this was something he said way back in the 60s?
Yeah, I mean, the people are reacting to it now. Like anything involving Cuban-American relations in Florida, there's a lot of emotion and nobody wants to be on the wrong side of it. How much it would actually matter to voters in November, I don't know. There's going to be, if he's running in November, if he's a nominee, he's going to be running against Trump. So that's going to be the comparison. And I think especially these other comments he made about the Soviet Union in the 80s and how great the Moscow subway is, I'm not sure it's going to have that much resonance with voters when you have a president now Soviet Union is gone. What's there now is Russia, and the president we have in office is very, very favorable to Russia, much more than Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. Well, the Moscow subway is quite pretty. And it was built also as a bomb shelter.
So.
No, it is. It's gorgeous. But that's neither here nor there. The campaign, the healthcare stuff, the Cuba stuff, is Bernie Sanders in the process? Because his polling has been great, at least until that comment. Is he about to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory here?
I don't think so. I mean, Bernie is a little bit like Trump in that he has very, very devoted followers who love everything he says, and that will give him some leeway to say, to have things pop out about his past, or also for him to take some unorthodox positions later on. It's helped Bernie, just like it helped Trump in 2016. The people running against him are all basically, sort of canceling each other out. There's three or four other people who are adding up to 45%, but Bernie wins with 40% because none of them can consolidate. So I think he's doing pretty well. I don't see, unless you see a lot of people dropping out, or somebody like Mike Bloomberg really taking off, Bernie's going to be hard to beat.
Yeah. Does it bug you that he has reneged on his promise to release his full medical records? And are you guys going to try and, I don't know, send your investigative unit to find out what's in those records?
Well, obviously, if any of your listeners have Bernie Sanders' healthcare records and are willing to share them, we would like to see them. But, you know, he'd be running against Donald Trump. And Trump, who hasn't released his tax returns, hasn't really released his medical records. That's he put true. Out that doctor who looked like he was not the most trustworthy doctor in the world, and then later on said that Trump stole his medical records and made him sign that letter. I don't think if you're running against Trump, you know, Bernie's that's going to have the same impact.
Now, if Donald Trump wins a second term, there are some people who think it's the beginning of a dynasty. Not that he would try to get the, you know, get the Constitution changed and run for a third term, Bloomberg style, by the way. But that Donald Trump Jr. is somehow being groomed to succeed him, and Trump Jr. himself seems to have embraced this idea of being the undersecretary of trolling for the Trump administration. Is that a serious thing?
Well, I think in Don Jr.'s mind, that possibility is there. I mean, I think of all the Trump children, Don Jr. seems the most likely to follow his father into elective office or elective politics. But you're right that Don Jr.'s main feature now seems to be trolling. Like, he speaks to a very sort of angry, trollish part of the Republican base. You know, we think of Donald Trump Sr. as kind of a troll, but really, he had a variety of policy positions. People thought he was relatively moderate when he, at the time of the 2016 election. You know, he was about more than just sort of like giving the finger to liberals. And Don Jr. seems to really concentrate on the giving the finger to liberals part of it. Maybe he'll expand out and have some sort of policy agenda, but it's going to be hard to win an election if you're just about basically, you know, owning the libs.
Yeah. What is the status of the house cleaning operation in the White House, where Trump is getting rid of anybody he considers disloyal?
Well, they brought in this guy, Johnny McEntee, who had been a White House official and is now back. And supposedly he and Clarence Thomas's wife are working on, who's not in government, are working on, you know, identifying political appointees, basically people Trump already appointed who he now believes are disloyal or not loyal enough. It's a crazy thing to be doing in the middle of a epidemic or a pandemic, to be going through the government and, you know, making everybody afraid and rooting out people you think are not part of the Trump loyalist tribe. But they may still be doing it.
Mm-hmm. And can we, now that we have some perspective, can we come to a conclusion on whether impeachment was a wise idea or turned out to be a dumb idea?
I don't think electorally it will matter that much. You know, I don't think that there was a bump in Trump's polling numbers, but that's a long time before the election. A lot of other stuff's going to happen. We're probably going to forget, like most things in the Trump era, we're probably going to forget that impeachment even happened. What the Democrats said at the beginning was, look, we don't think we're going to succeed in getting him out of office. We think we may even boost his poll numbers. But if we don't do this, if we just lay back and say it's fine that he solicited, you know, political interference from the Ukrainians, that, you know, we're letting him cross a boundary unchallenged that he won't ever go back across. So, you know, from that perspective, I think it did what they wanted to. It drew attention to what Trump was doing, and it sort of chastened Trump and threw him off his game for a little while. You know, I think it's still too early to say, you know, did it reelect him? Did it damage his reelection projects? Did it not matter at all?
One more thing I want to get your take on. Michael Bloomberg has openly said that he is actually paying social media influencers or people with large Twitter followings to tweet pro-Bloomberg tweets. And this is part of his strategy for winning the presidency. Doesn't this play into exactly what Bernie Sanders has been saying about billionaires trying to buy the election?
I mean, yes. You could look at it from two ways. One, like this, if you're Bloomberg, you got to win the election. You know, you got to innovate, right? So I'm sure he's thinking, like, well, you know, why don't I take advantage of this strategy no one's ever tried before? But yes, I mean, everything about the Bloomberg campaign is basically designed to at least buy your attention. I don't think he can buy the election, as the last debate showed, but he's trying to buy your attention. And this is one way. Yeah, I think Bernie Sanders' point that billionaires have that power when nobody else does, Bloomberg's kind of a demonstration of that.
David Farenthold, live from the Washington Post. He joins us every Tuesday. David, thanks very much.
Thank you. You can ring my
bell, Rachel Bell. This is Seattle's Morning News. Now let's talk about food fads with our food expert and the host of the Your Last Meal podcast, Rachel Bell. I didn't know that avocado toast actually was a fad. I thought it was just sort of a punchline. So in other words, avocado toast just started racing through restaurants all across America?
Oh, yeah. Avocado toast has become a national trend or an international trend in Western places. It's really popular in places like Australia and the States. And this article is talking about the fact that eating trendy food can actually be harmful for the world. So for people and for the environment. So they give a few examples. So starting with avocados, like we just said, avocado toast, super popular. Everybody wants guacamole on their tacos. But the price of this is that somebody has to grow all these avocados. It takes resources. So number one, it's causing deforestation and excessive water use in Mexico and Chile. But also now the freaking cartel is running.
Yeah, there's an avocado cartel.
Yes, because it's green gold. They are worth so much money now that a lot of people are actually dying at the hands of avocados in Mexico. They also talked about almond milk. A lot of people now know how much it costs to grow a single almond, which is a lot of money. A lot of people blame the drought in California in past years on almond growth. So they're saying it's not that good to drink so much almond milk. They say the same about quinoa.
So now it's ecologically responsible to get your milk from cows again?
I know. What?
That's crazy.
Or, I don't know. Go macadamia. Whatever you can milk. Make some milk out of it.
They don't actually milk the nuts.
Have you? How do you know?
I've looked it up on YouTube. They squish them.
I don't know. What was your sex ed like? Are you sure that the nuts don't have tiny udders on them? Maybe they're internal.
Now we do need sex ed.
I know. One more example of this and then we can talk about it. But they talk about quinoa, which has been like a staple food for people in Peru and Bolivia for thousands of years. Then in the West, they're like, oh, it's gluten-free and it's high in protein. It's good for my keto diet. And so now it is over-farmed. And the Bolivian farmers who've been eating it for thousands of years, they can no longer afford to eat their own crops because the price has gone up at least six times. Is that what sixfold means? Six times? Yeah, six times. And so now the people in Bolivia are eating instant noodles instead of this really, really healthy quinoa.
The West ruins everything.
We do, don't we? We are the worst. So they said that it is natural for humans to copy each other. Like food trends have always been the thing because you eat with your family, your neighbors. You're just going to kind of eat what everybody else is eating. But now because of social media, you know, you see somebody eating avocado toast and it's a beautiful, well-lit picture. And now everybody's eating it. So the article says, stop eating so trendily, made up a new word, and start eating some things nobody likes.
Yes, I love this. This is social media telling you to stop obeying social media.
Exactly.
Why don't you just buy what's cheapest? Isn't that really the way that you can save the world? Because once avocado toast gets expensive, I just go and I buy peanut butter. Peanut butter on toast is pretty darn good. Melted cheese on toast is fine. You can live on that.
Oh, so old school, Dave. It doesn't sound cool to me. Are you using any kind of fashionable cheeses that kill people in Bolivia?
No.
I'm not interested.
I sprinkle cinnamon on it sometimes.
Yeah. Wow, that is Trey Exotic.
Isn't that? Well, because it happened to be on the front of the spice rack. I just took it out and said, let's try this. It's not going to kill me.
So many people in the food world are so snobby that, you know, if you tell them that you're eating at some restaurant that was really popular in the 90s, people, that place isn't cool anymore. It's not, you know, there's like a lot of food snobbery. So I think that if you're in that world, you get really peer pressured into eating the cool foods. And even think about it, like when you were a kid, what you brought to school in the cafeteria for lunch, you didn't want to get made fun of. Like everybody with an immigrant parent knows what it's like to open your lunch and everyone's plugging their nose and they say your lunch is stinky. Everyone just wants to fit in and eat trendy foods.
You know, I was making some chocolate chip cookies over the weekend.
Oh, those quinoa avocado ones I love?
No.
Oh.
They're made with chocolate chips and walnuts. And I burned them. So what did I do? I said, these are biscotti.
Biscottis are not burnt.
you dip them in milk. That doesn't matter, Rachel.
Okay.
I call them biscotti.
Okay.
And you dip them in milk. And when you dip them in milk, guess what? They get softer and you can actually bite through them. Now, does that make me a snob or an anti-snob? I don't know really which side I fall on now.
I think that makes you very anti-food waste.
It makes me practical.
Which we love, practical.
Which means I go, I buy the cheapest thing, which is obviously not going to be the fatty thing. And I save a lot of money and I'm still nutrished.
That is the Julia Child method, you know? It's like, oh, you have a crack in your cheesecake? Put some frosting on top.
Exactly.
You drop your chicken on the floor. I hope no one else was in the kitchen.
I've got a case of shad, of pickled shad. It's a fish, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to spread it on toast when I get home, sprinkle cheese and cinnamon on top, right? Because it's cheap.
Your tone, you're getting aggressive.
But if I post it on social media, it'd become a fad, and suddenly there would be shad cartels.
A shad fad.
I think we've taken this as far as it can go.
I think so. I think it's time to go now.
Thank you, Rachel.
You're welcome. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.